This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. The ancient Romans offered cults to innumerable deities who influenced every aspect of both the natural world and human affairs. But Diana was special, goddess of the moon, the hunt, and the underworld. Scholar Karen Green says her sanctuary in a crater near Rome indicates a deity closely involved with nature, especially the wild. But her core identity is still that of a nymph-like nature goddess concerned primarily with women. This hour, we'll talk to Green, the University of Iowa Classics professor. Her new book is Roman Religion, The Cult of Diana at Aricia. Also this hour, Green's husband, Peter, another classic scholar at Iowa, tells us about his friendship with the late British novelist, poet, and playwright William Golding, best known for his novel Lord of the Flies. The goddess Diana and the author Golding this hour on Talk of Iowa after the news. And welcome to Talk of Iowa for this Thursday, the 8th of July. I'm Dennis Reese. Professor Karen Green writes, Diana's rule in her kingdom in the crater was untroubled. She was the goddess of change, of the decay that must precede renewal, of life, of death. Wildness was in her nature. Diana was a multi-purpose goddess, the goddess of the moon, the hunt, and the underworld. She was the goddess of roads, and her groves and sanctuaries were always in the wild. Green goes on to write, Diana was a major goddess at Aricia, a moon goddess with an ancient and complex hunting cult. Karen Green, professor of classics at the University of Iowa, has a new book published by Cambridge, Roman Religion, and the Cult of Diana at Aricia. And welcome, Karen.
Thank you very much.
It's a great book. Fascinating figure, the goddess Diana. And you had a reason to write this book, I know, to clarify some things, because historians and scholars and classicists have written about Diana, I'm sure, for hundreds of years.
Indeed, and the ancients themselves found this particular cult extremely interesting. It is the wildness of Diana, who, as a gentle-seeming goddess, the goddess of the moon, beautiful young woman, is very strangely assorted, people thought then and now, with the kind of violence that is associated with hunting, and in particular with the priesthood that characterized her cult and made it famous throughout the Mediterranean. It is the Rex Nemerensis, the king of the wood, that's the literal translation of the Latin, is a priest who had to be an escaped slave. And in order to maintain or achieve the priesthood, he had to kill in mortal combat his predecessor. This absolutely fascinated the ancients, and of course it has become mesmerizing for modern scholars who generally find it very distasteful. And so the difficulty has been to explain why this beautiful goddess, who is also a goddess of childbirth and of protection, a guardian goddess, why she would have a priest, and presumably the most important priest in her cult, somebody who was as low as a slave, who was a criminal slave, that is, he was escaped, and who was a murderer. And this particular problem fascinated me. I came to it from the conflict between Pompey and Caesar, because a poem about the Civil War, in fact, characterized Caesar as the Rex Nemerensis and as killing his predecessor, Pompey. So the violence of the cult was incorporated into the image of the Romans themselves. So the question is, how does this sacred, this cult, incorporate the sacred image? And that's the question that I essentially was asking in order to write this book.
I also want to introduce Karen, your husband Peter is also with us this hour on Talk of Iowa. Peter Green, also a classic scholar. And later in the hour, we'll talk with Peter about his latest essay, which will appear in the New Republic this month. And it's a review of a new book about the author William Golding, best known for, of course, for his novel Lord of the Flies. Peter, welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here.
I know this is your wife's book, but I'm sure you have some comments and opinions about the goddess Diana.
And you're welcome to express those opinions. I'm sure Karen will understand. But I'm sure you have a fascination with the goddess Diana also.
Absolutely. I mean, I come to it outside. I'm a Hellenist, not a Romanist, basically. I suffered through the entire creation of this book.
In the
best sense. It was in the best sense.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, also I went to NAMI and to all the on-site stuff with Karen. And so what I can absolutely confirm is the physical reality of everything she describes and how appropriate the site was for somebody like Diana. There's this huge bowl with the almost circular lake, very calm at the bottom, known as the Speculum Dianae, the mirror of Diana.
This is a volcanic crater.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And it's still very much there today.
Absolutely very much there today. And how appropriate it is that the area, which is so fertile, should now provide every kind of flowers for Rome. You know, the goddess is still doing her thing.
It is an amazingly beautiful place and still has that quality of being a sacred space. And the mirror of Diana is absolutely genuine. If you go there, the reflection in the lake is absolutely perfect. And I can imagine that at night, with a full moon, the reflection of the moon in the lake must have been a really stunning experience.
Now, this is a place called Arisha.
Yes.
Now, it's still called Arisha.
Still called Arisha.
After all these years.
Yes. In fact, the town Arisha.
It's near Rome.
It's about 12 miles from Rome on mm-hmm. the Via Appia. So if you're going south from Rome, you will pass right through it.
Yeah. Are there, I mean, if you're a tourist there, are there signs? Is it a tourist attraction today?
It's not signposted, no. You have to know to go there. If you do know, however, there is this little roundabout that you're going through, and you just have to take you can hardly see the road that leads off it. And all of a sudden, you're over the ridge of the crater and you're down into the crater. And it's like you're a million miles away from Rome. It's absolutely beautiful, unspoiled. A few fishermen down there and the people at the museum and the people who raise the flowers. And that's it.
And this was the place where the ancient Romans went for healing.
Yes, it was also a healing cult, and that is understandable about hunting cults. Hunting is about killing and wounding, and therefore it is also about healing wounds, because hunters become wounded just as animals do. And in fact, hunters always had to use dogs, so if their dogs became wounded, they had to take care of the dogs. And mm-hmm. forest lore becomes essential to a hunter. So knowing what plants could help heal, could help poison, all of this lore is part of the hunting cult ritual. Therefore, when it is applied to humans outside the hunting cult, it becomes what we would call a healing cult. And in fact, their knowledge was extremely extensive. I had the pleasure of talking to our vet about okay. the healing of mange. Yeah. And in fact, the recipe that they give from the hunting cult is exactly what has been used up to the modern period when antibiotics replaced the old, essentially tar-based medicines, which kill the mange. So it was a very wise cult in its knowledge of healing remedies, of ointments, potions, things to take internally, externally, and so forth. Yes.
So it was a veterinary center too, as well.
Yes,
is what you're saying. Yeah.
Yes, indeed, indeed.
Karen, what can you just paint us a picture of what this area, Arisha, this whole area would have looked like in 100 A.D.? I mean, were there thousands of Romans there doing rituals and being healed? Or what sort of a place?
I think it would have been fairly heavily populated by people coming in. Now, the city Arisha is on the outside of the crater. So you have to go inside the crater and down to the floor of the crater beside the lake where the sanctuary was. And the sanctuary was very complex. It also, as in fact many healing places are today, some place that tourists would go to just because they were curious. And they would walk around. There were many, many pieces of art and sculpture and monuments that were around that you would just want to look at. In fact, it'd be very like going to St. Peter's or to any church that had beautiful works of art in it.
Sounds a little like Lourdes.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You know, and there would be people who were there because they wanted to be healed. There would be people who were there because they always wanted to go to sanctuaries. You know, they liked it. Yeah. You know, it's a kind of traveler's thing. But sanctuaries like this also were banks. Because a lot of people from foreign places came with foreign money, they would have to be exchanges. And there would be bakeries because that was one of the ritual treatments was to take a cookie, essentially, and let it crumble. And it would represent all the deformed parts of the body.
You know, when I read that, I thought, am I reading this correctly?
Yes.
You're actually talking about deformed pastries. And of course, I love pastries. And I'm thinking, but there was a purpose for this. They baked, you call it a cookie to represent the physical ailments.
Yes.
And then when you were healed at the, I'm calling it a temple, but it's not.
It's a sanctuary.
Sanctuary. Then you would get a better looking cookie the second time around.
Well, you would, it's very much like the Navajo sand painting.
Okay.
Where a medicine man would paint certain ritual pictures in sand, and then the destruction and the reassembly of the sand is a ritual healing. And so while it's I think the cookies were used in a casual way by people who just made fun of it, not everybody took this seriously, even in the ancient world. But in its ritual, spiritual sense, it's breaking down the cookie to its elements of earth, that is flour, fire, that is the heat that bakes it, water, which is what binds it to be baked, and air, which you need to make the fire. And breaking it down to its four elements, you then take those four elements and you would, I think, probably bake a new cookie that would be
a new and better cookie.
A new and better cookie, yes. A new and better self, yes.
All right. Sounds sounds like a plan to me. We'll take about a minute break and back to our conversation on Roman religion and the cult of Diana at Arisha. Karen Green, professor of classics, University of Iowa, and her husband, classics scholar Peter Green, back in a minute.
I love you, but do you love me? Oh, Diana, can't you see? I love you.
Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese with Peter and Karen Green. They're classicists, authors, and Karen's new book, Roman Religion and the Cult of Diana at Arisha, published by Cambridge. And we're going to talk to Peter later about his long friendship with William Golding. He has a review of a new biography about Golding, which is the book is out now, I believe. Peter,
it is out, yes, indeed.
And it's good to know you love the book.
Yes, I like the book, indeed. I think it makes Bill Golding slightly more of a kind of classic comic figure than he actually was. It is quite true that he had no sense of direction and that he was always falling on things. This is true, but not quite as much as you'd guess from the book.
Well, we'll get back to Diana in a minute. As long as we're on a little bit of a roll here about Golding, let me just ask you, Peter, when did you first meet him?
Oh, this was in the middle 50s. We were both co-opted onto the panel of the Book Society in London, which is the equivalent of the Book of the Month Club, by Tony Godwin, who was the director then. And Bill was very much on his best behavior then, you know, very tweedy, very amusing, but also, I think, I noticed at the time, beautifully subversive of a lot of the popular stuff we were meant to select and didn't. And I was curious, and we had lunch a couple of times, more several times together, and we found we liked each other's style. And I had already, before that, before I met him, I'd been writing to him about his first two novels, and I got, as a complete stranger, he quite happily sent me detailed replies. They were good, meaty, and often extremely witty, extremely funny. So we met to discuss this, and there turned out to be this wonderful split between the William Golding who wrote the novels and who was very much into the business of man's fall and original sin and, you know, as he said, man creates evil as the bee produces honey, all of that. But then there was the Bill Golding one met, who was extremely good company, that one would love to go drinking with, who was well-read, who was fun, who was immensely humane, and in fact became one of the closest and best friends I had, you know, over half a century.
Now, of course, most people know him for Lord of the Flies. Probably more people have, I suppose, seen the movie than read the book. I don't know, but millions have read the book, obviously. But it turns out that's he wrote other novels that are not nearly as well known. And your favorite is of his works is another novel, right?
Yes, I think my favorite of I've got two close favorites. One is the second novel he wrote, called The Inheritors, which is about Neanderthal man. And just as in Lord of the Flies, he took a very popular concept of the island life, that is Ballantyne's Coral Island, and stood it completely on its head, saying that this was not going to produce the kind of happy fun that Ballantyne suggested. It was going to produce a reversion to savagery. So in the same way, he took H.G. Wells and the secularist development of the idea of Neanderthal man as the grisly folk and their suppression by Homo sapiens as a great move in the direction of peace, law and order, and creativity, and turned that on its head too, on the principle that the Neanderthals were the true innocents, the prelapsarians, and that Homo sapiens, because of his knowledge, his sort of Promethean knowledge, was the true creator of evil. And the way he gets inside the mind, the cloudy mind of these Neanderthalers who see things in images rather than any other way is quite extraordinary. I always remember at one point the leading Neanderthal, Locke, is being shot at by a Homo sapiens with a poisoned arrow and can't understand quite what's going on. He somehow thinks he's being given a present. I love that. No, that novel, actually it was one of Bill Golding, it was his favorite too. Mm-hmm. That and the other one I really love was The Spire, which is actually based on the creation, against all odds, of the 400-foot spire of Salisbury Cathedral, mm-hmm. Which even now, a very recent archaeologist went there and said that spire has no business to be standing.
That's the oldest standing example, isn't it?
Absolutely, any pre-1400 church, yes.
Right, yeah.
And the reason it shouldn't be standing is that there's a high water table, and they only had 4 feet of foundation, and this was just brushwood, rubble, and stuff.
Yeah.
And then the creation of this 400-foot tower put over 6,500 tons of extra weight on the pillars at the four corners that the tower stood on. And as a result, the stone, with this massive stone, actually bent inwards, and you can still see it bending inwards today. And as he said, the stone sang. You know, there was an incredible noise produced by this extreme pressure. And out of all this, Bill created a wonderful novel as the conflict between the dean. By the way, Salisbury is never mentioned. It is just treated as a fable, a cathedral. It's not located in any place. But the dean, Jocelyn, believes that anything is possible by miracles and prayer, and he goes all out for the construction of this tower, and he's dealing constantly in conflict with Roger Mason, the great master builder, who can calculate to the minute practically when the weight of the tower should bring it down in complete collapse. And of course, it didn't and it doesn't. And the great kick of the novel is that today, outside the novel, we know that the miracle worked. We don't know why it worked. And this is perfect for Bill, who liked every sort of fable of this sort to be open-ended, this endless dialogue between belief and the miraculous and scientific logic.
Well, it's clear
something
that
he got from his father.
Yeah. Well, it's clear that William Golding fans need to read more than Lord of the Flies, and that's I learned that from your essays on what you call him, Bill Golding, because he was a close personal friend. And you write, Bill, in his own way, was a mixture of improbably coexisting elements, science and deism, poetic vision, the heart of darkness, solitude, and outgoing companionability. Didn't say that quite right. But he had a perilously volcanic temperament. So we had a very complex man, and I'm sure you had great, great conversations with him over the years, Peter.
Absolutely. You know, he did, and this is something that Carey's biography brings out, he went on tremendous benders sometimes.
Okay.
But this is very different. I mean, a lot of people have compared him over his drinking with Kingsley Amis. I happen to know both of them, and the difference between them is that Kingsley was the kind of professional lush who kept a keg of single malt whiskey in his working office, whereas Bill would be perfectly ordinary and then sort of simply go on an absolute, as I say, on a bender.
Yeah.
To release stress.
Okay. We're going to take a break on Talk of Iowa, speaking with Karen Green and Peter Green, and we'll get back to the goddess Diana, because we have two conflicting topics sort of today. But I think they go together somewhat well, myself. We'll get back. Calls and questions, 866-780-9100, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. A little dirty Diana here. As we go to break. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese, speaking today to Karen and Peter Green. Karen, professor of classics at the University of Iowa, has a new book, Roman Religion and the Cult of Diana at Orisha. Peter Green, also a classicist, retired. He has several interesting articles on the life of William Golding, the author, playwright, etc. An accomplished, a very fascinating man. A new review out this month in the New Republic, an essay written by Peter Green about a new biography of William Golding. But back to Diana. And again, if you have questions, comments about our topics today with our authors, 866-780-9100. Karen, we talked about the veterinary care, which I found really interesting at Orisha, and you say that the care was given to hunting hounds, preparation for the birth of puppies, the care of the nursing mother, I'm quoting. Mm-hmm. And then you say the goddess would seem on the face of it to have combined the various skills of family practitioner, psychiatrist, and veterinarian. This is entirely consistent with her identity as a goddess of the moon, governs the growth of plants and animals and the physical changes that either heal or harm the body as a hunting deity. And then you ask the question later in the paragraph, what exactly did Diana do for those who were ill?
Yes, I think that probably the best way for us to approach it is, in fact, from the idea of what was now, I think, most familiar to people as sports psychology.
Okay.
That is, in the ancient world, Hippocratic medicine, rational medicine, could only treat maybe 10% of the illnesses that afflicted people. If you had cancer or malaria or dysentery or any of the diseases that could afflict you, if you had cirrhosis of the liver, there was nothing a medical doctor could do for you. That doesn't mean that what the healing sanctuaries did was cheating or duplicitous. What they were trying to approach was a way of healing, if possible, that involves dealing with the psychology, that is, giving people ways of thinking that allowed them to become better, and perhaps to achieve the kinds of miracles that we know do happen, and we still have no explanation. And if those didn't work, then to make the individual as comfortable as possible and to allow the individual to find a spiritual understanding of what they were going through and to recognize that death was the end. And it was a necessary end. There was no evading it. And for this individual, if that was the end they had to face, then to come to an acceptance of it. It is, in fact, what spiritual counselors do in the hospital today. And I think that it is very easy to find this as something that is suspicious and misleading. And naturally, they must have had things that we would regard as extremely dangerous. But mm-hmm. we also know the Hippocratics wrote a treatise on curing curvature of the spine, which involved tying the sufferer to a ladder and dropping it, which, if you even tried it, would tell you wouldn't work. The idea of harm and of damage, certainly the best practitioners, in fact, all practitioners, really would not want to do harm. But their understanding of what worked and what didn't work was extremely limited because they didn't have the tools for analysis that we have today.
Right.
So within the range that the ancient healers had, they worked with psychology, they worked with ritual, and they worked to help the individual come to terms with what they were suffering, with pain, with disappointment. I think that's one of the great things about serious injury, which is that the disappointment that you aren't the person you were.
Mm-hmm.
And that disappointment is part – dealing with that is part of what any doctor now must deal with a cancer patient or somebody who has lost a limb. One of the things I talk about, in fact, is the argument, which I think is very strong, that sanctuaries were places where warriors, soldiers who had what we would call post-traumatic disorder, came to try and deal with the nightmares, with the anger, with the rage that they were put in that position, that they became the person that they became through these experiences, and the fear that they have, the guilt that they carried with them. Obviously, not every soldier did this happen to, but this was something that the sanctuary actually recognized and actually had rituals for bringing a person in and resolving these very serious issues. So when I say she's a psychiatrist, I am thinking in those terms.
As you say, ritual birth of a new well-formed self is the goal of all of these rituals. What sort of – did they meditate? Did they pray? Did the ancient Romans dance?
Well, we have almost no evidence. I managed to piece together the business of the cookie, the little biscuit, from various bits of evidence and knowledge of comparable practices in the modern world. I suppose, and what, again, from the evidence, there was a kind of maze, which, again, we know is used now in spiritual healing. The idea that going through your illness is like going through a maze to an end. And they must have used performance because there's a small theater there. And these would have been performances, again, that would have allowed people to recognize psychological illnesses in particular. There's a very wonderful book called Achilles in Vietnam by a modern psychiatrist who treats soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder. And he has given them and shown them how to read the Iliad, which is a wonderful, wonderful poem about that particular issue. And it has opened the doors to allow them to express their illness, their distress, their fear and guilt. And that kind of performance, the performance of poetry, the performance of drama, is a way of releasing people from the lack of knowledge of what they've suffered into a kind of knowledge that allows them to discuss it, to discuss the experience, but also to control it, because it's the lack of control that's so frightening. Great art gives shape and direction and a beginning and an end. And this is where I think you were saying there's not a lot of correspondence between Peter on Golding and me on Diana. But this is, in fact, where the correspondence is, because mm-hmm. The Lord of the Flies is a great work of art that allows us to examine our own violent instinctive reactions and our love of power and the fact that we need controls of civilization. That is exactly what art did, I think, at the Sanctuary of Diana. It took people into their very basic instincts, and it allowed them to examine those instincts, how they worked out, the horrific consequences of them, and then to step back into civilization much wiser for having the experience. And that is one of the things that I think Bill Golding, that was a clue to what made Golding such a great author, was he touched these themes that we all recognize. And, you know, the Lord of the Flies is set in a specific time, mm-hmm. immediately when we're trying to deal with the bomb.
Right.
But it is going to resonate for people for centuries, mm-hmm. because it doesn't depend on the bomb. It depends on just that moment of being isolated and finding out the worst parts of yourself. And that is what makes it so great.
Very well said. And I'm sure, Peter, you would agree with that.
Well, yes. And I was also going to bring up something that I'd like to hear Karen talk more about. And that is the extraordinary register of ex post facto dedications at Epidaurus from the healing shrine there, which shows what an enormous gap there is psychologically between then and now, which is, you know, this is a wonderful collection. People went to the healing shrine, and they had what was known as incubatio. They slept in the shrine overnight, and things were supposed to appear to them in dreams, and they were supposed to be better the next day. And then they were supposed to write an account of what had happened to them. And there are literally hundreds of these, and you would have thought with this enormous amount of evidence, there would have been a great deal written about them, but there isn't, because some of them are so remarkable and so extraordinary that you find it difficult in modern terms to believe that they were actually true and represented what actually happened.
Yes, and again, this is where the idea that Golding had in The Inheritors of the Neanderthals who thought through images as opposed to analytical thinking comes up, because one of the inscriptions is by a woman who wants comes to the sanctuary to be operated on for tapeworm, and you can't do that.
Now, we still have these little essays?
Yes, we have.
That's
them.
Amazing.
We do indeed.
Yes. And she is clearly a character. In any case, in the treatment, she writes that her head was cut off. Mm-hmm. Because she thinks the sons of the gods, who are the healers, are incompetent. And she wrote this down, and it was kept, and we still have it. And she was so determined that she wasn't going to be laughed at, mm-hmm. that she insisted one of the priests come and verify to her that her head had been cut off. And she insisted that they send for the god, not just his sons, but the god himself. And he came. And he sewed her head back on, she says, and then he operated on her for the tapeworm, and she was all better. This is one of those that, you know, how can you not laugh? And yet it is absolutely serious. It's in the third person, but it is definitely, I mean, you can't imagine that the priests were very happy to have this particular inscription put up. So it must be written by her. Her name is Aristagora. And it is the kind of thing where my explanation of this is that they gave her opium,
okay,
which would be a natural thing to do, and before they operated. And some people react very badly to opium, and they could not control dosage. It's very difficult, and so she had some very bad dreams or images, and I think that they probably put some kind of screen across her neck, so that she couldn't see the rest of her body and she couldn't feel it. And for her, that was cutting off her head. And she was not going to be argued with. It was very clear from this inscription. She had her head cut off and nobody was telling her differently. And
you can see why modern scholars are rather shy of dealing with this material.
But within, if you step away from what we know about anatomy to a world in which an individual, a woman, would not know what happened if you had her head cut off, and was absolutely implicit in her belief in the god and his power, that she could think that and that she would say that. And the genius of the healers was, after they stopped arguing with her, was to let her go, to accept that that is how she saw it, and therefore that is how she had to be treated. So they did something that for her represented sewing her head back on. And
well, she felt better by the time she left.
And she felt better, yeah, and she thought she was rid of tapeworms, and they couldn't have operated on her for tapeworms because they would have killed her, and she didn't die. So we have to think about ancient healing in terms of people who do not know the things that we know we just accept as automatic. And it's a very complex matter. And one of the great insights I think the ancient healers had, was that it is a matter of treating the person, not the illness. That is, the person's perception of what is wrong with them is the thing that must be addressed, as well as whatever might be known about the physical characteristics.
So these ancient healers are really quite advanced in a lot of respects.
In many respects, I think they were, yes.
Who invented the goddess Diana?
She's
$64,000 question.
She must come from, you know, the steppes of Asia with the Indo-Europeans who come west and south and settle into Italy. She's a very old goddess who must come from the hunter-gatherer period. And but she is also a warrior goddess, and therefore she remains as society forms and soldiers are needed. I think a lot of moderns find it very difficult to conceive of females as warriors, deities of warriors. But this is a total misperception of ancient religion. And I think that Diana as a warrior goddess is extremely powerful, so powerful that even after Rome defeated Orisha, she remained a very significant goddess for Roman soldiers and soldiers throughout Italy. The kind of treatment that was needed, the kind of organization, and this again is where the connection with Golding comes in, because what she offers is organization in the wild. She's not a goddess of city organization, but of warriors who must stay organized when they are in, and they have every opportunity to turn like the children in Lord of the Flies, simply become wild. And they must behave in ways that make them acceptable to the community when they come back. This is what Diana did. She organized all these horrible things, whether it's the wildness of disease that afflicts you, or the wildness of going out and killing people that afflicts you, or just the wildness of a terrible earthquake, mm-hmm. or something like that. That reassurance that you have somebody to go to who understands the wild, who's not afraid of it, and who will help you think it through.
And this links up with Bill Golding again, because his experience in wartime,
yes.
Where he was extremely brave and in action, mm-hmm. gave him an awareness, he said, of sin, of responsibility,
yes.
of human guilt, of human evil.
Okay. I want to get a caller on. Patrick's calling from Wisconsin. Patrick, good morning.
Good morning. I'm reading a book this summer called The Memoirs of Phoebe by
yes.
Marguerite Yourcenar. And how widespread were these mystery religions, the cult of Isis and Mithraism?
Yeah, we have a bad connection there, but I think maybe you got the question.
Yes, I think it's how widespread were the mystery religions?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the mystery religions as such actually were very widespread, and they had many forms. Isis was one, Mithras was another, Bacchus was another, Ceres, Demeter was another. There were many smaller ones.
Not to mention Eleusis.
Well, the Demeter.
Demeter, yes.
Yes, exactly. And they were very powerful because they offered this sense of bringing people into a greater wisdom. It is knowledge that people are seeking. And this is a point I make in my book about Diana. Often when you're sick or in need of any kind of need that takes you to a spiritual experience, you are seeking not so much in the first instance release, but just understanding of what situation you're in and what it means. And the mystery religions all over the Mediterranean brought this knowledge to people. Now, they were not in competition. This is a later Christian view of religion that is simply not characteristic of the other religions in the Mediterranean, because people could be initiated into Eleusis and into the mysteries of Isis and anybody they wanted, and then they could go worship at the temple of Jupiter. It was not a matter of the gods quarreling among themselves or one being better than the other. I think for the ancient world, at the best sense, their approach to the divine was to try and find knowledge in as many ways as possible. And it was always understood to be incomplete knowledge because we're human and they were divine. But the effort was towards knowledge, and so.
But there's no text associated with these
no
ancient.
Text.
And there's not a written
no.
beliefs and creeds no. and behaviors are supposed to follow, right?
No, there isn't.
The emphasis is, as they said, on praxis, on action, rather than
and experience.
Yes,
okay.
Action and experience.
Action and experience.
Yes,
indeed.
And inherited experience. And and they were very interested in what each other did too. It was a shared thing. So you do find that the religions are growing in many ways more like each other as certain things become popular, and The mystery religion certainly did become very, very popular, and Christianity had to expend a considerable amount of effort to stamp them out.
We just have a minute left, and I want to go to Peter just to talk about your last meeting with William Golding. You weren't expecting him you were thinking you would have had a lot more time to spend with him, but it was a meeting, and then he was gone literally in a few days.
Well, this was quite extraordinary. It was in June 1993. I was on my way to Greece, and I stopped off in England on the way because Bill and Anne wanted me to spend a long weekend with them down in Cornwall. They had this new lovely house, Tullamore, and it was a wonderful weekend. I mean, Bill drove me in from Truro Station. He had got a lovely new Jaguar. We went out Saturday evening to what is disgustingly known in England as a gastro pub, which means, you know, where you can get a decent dinner there. And the staff was all over him because he'd just had a knighthood, and it was, oh, Sir William this and Sir William that.
And we just have about 20 seconds.
Yeah. And the thing was, he was on cracking form, drove me back into Truro Station on Monday, and then 5 days later in Athens, I was reading a paper, and there was this picture, and I thought, what's he been up to now? And the answer was, he'd been dying. And my first thought was, he can't be dead. He drove me into Truro on Monday.
It's an amazing story. We're out of time. I wish we had more time. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Karen Green's new book, Roman Religion and the Cult of Diana et Aricia, published by Cambridge. He's a professor of classics at the University of Iowa. Peter Green, former fiction critic for the London Daily Telegraph, has a new review of the biography of William Golding, written by John Carey. Talk of Iowa, production assistance today from Rosalind Sixby. I'm Dennis Reese. Thanks for listening.